you know, I've got quite a lot of guidance, and you need to keep your library up to date. And the more you add into it, and you know, it's hard to keep it well organized. But my big beef is that the ICO guidance may have a version number on it, but they don't tell you what's changed between the versions. So as I said earlier in the day, that I downloaded in prep for this session the new PECA guidance, which is version 2.4.49, and I checked our library, we had version 2.4.37, and I thought, how have I missed 12 variations of the guidance? What has changed to justify putting out 12 different updates? And whilst there was a version on the latest guidance, there's no indication of what had changed. So I had to load both PDFs into a PDF comparison platform and check. And it appeared to me the only changes were the GDPR had been changed to the UK GDPR. But even so, you know, it's just hard work to have to go through that process. You're saying, Jason, also that the European data protection guidance is not supplemented to earlier Working Part 29 guidance, but replaces it. Maybe come on and talk that one through. So I don't delete old guidance. I think a lot of it still has some interesting points. I just archive it. I don't know if you want to come on, Jason, and talk that one through. But I mean, in
do you want me to do that now?
Yeah, you can do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, more than welcome.
As I said in the note, I see this as a new trend. I'd never previously seen an EDP document saying this replaces Working Party 29 guidance. I'm struggling to remember which document it was, but I might be able to find that in a moment. But if it does, it really makes version control so important now, because it'd be very easy to say, oh, yes, I remember this. There's some WP29 guidance on it because it's a document that you're familiar with. Dive in and find that you're working on obsolete guidance, which has been totally replaced.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen the European Data Protection Board guidance saying that it either replaces or supplements. Some of it says it supplements. In fact, the new... No, it was the ICO's guidance, I said. There's certainly the data breach guidance, but it supplemented their own guidance, didn't it, I think, from memory. But that did say it was supplementary, the examples, data breach examples. So in our library, we've got the legislation. You know, we've got the EU GDPR, we've got the UK GDPR keyling, we've got the UK Data Protection Act keyling schedule, which has now replaced the old Data Protection Act copy we had. We've got various variations of the PECA, which is, again, that's quite hard to work with, 2003 original, plus all the variations to 2011, 15, 18, 19. We've got keep adding to it. So this week we were doing some work on the Communication Act 2003, so they'll put that in the library. We've got all the withdrawal agreement documentation in the library. Some of that will definitely become obsolete over the course of time. We've got RIPA, we've got IPA, anything that we come across as legislation, we add it into the library. But the principal things we work with on a day-to-day basis are the UK GDPR, the UK Data Protection Act and the PECA. And then we have kind of guidance. And I've put a list together of what I think is the key guidance. But when you look at the ICO's website, in fact, you know, we could have a look at it now, the guidance section for organizations is totally outdated, which is very, very unhelpful. And again, I'm not sure I particularly like the way that they have produced their GDPR guidance. So in the past, it was a downloadable PDF, but often when you log on and try and download the latest version of it to update your library, you can't download it. So it's a struggle. And as I said earlier, I find it difficult to work with totally electronic guidance because you click on hyperlinks and you're losing the flow of the guidance. So I find that particularly difficult. But the ICO's guidance, you know, there is some good stuff. And if you go back to the older guidance, like big data, the big data guidance I thought was really good when that was published back in 2014, I think it was. So there's a set of guidance the ICO has got, and you know the stuff that's really important is the statutory codes. So the Direct Marketing Code of Practice, again, this is in draft form. The Right of Access Code, which is in draft form and has been for nearly 2 years, And then the recently released data sharing code of practice statutory code, currently also in its draft form. The children's code, the age appropriate design code of practice, is not in its draft form anymore. But it makes you wonder, you know, what the relevance of draft codes of practice are, because certainly the SAR guidance is significantly different between the current SAR guidance on the ISO's website and the draft guidance. And if you look for SAR guidance on the ISO's website, you go to the old guidance, the 47 pager. You have to know where the 77 page, the new guidance, is. And when you get hold of it, it doesn't have a cover page, so it doesn't look like it's official. And I think this is really confusing to people that aren't necessarily doing this every day of the week for a living. For us, you know, we take the latest guidance and we say, well, this is the direction of travel. And usually it's elaborating on stuff, but sometimes it makes significant changes. I heard an entry there.
Yes, that was me. I was about to.
Oh, Ollie, you're here. Hello.
I returned.
Right.
I returned and you were full flow, so I thought I'd let you finish your thought.
All right. So how are you getting on? All right? Busy morning?
Not so bad. I've been catching up with the support desk team, seeing what's what, where we are on various things, helping our new star recruit, Matthew, with a few bits and pieces. He's writing some privacy policies this morning, which I've been helping him with. But are we currently in the guidance?
We're just talking about guidance. Yeah, we're talking about guidance. I mean, I don't want it to be a moan about the ICO, but I, you know, some of the stuff is good and some of the stuff is still in draft, and it has been for nearly 2 years. And we're looking for clear guidance that gives us, you know, cut through we can relate to, you know, use cases we can relate to. And some of it, you know, I was going through the direct market, the subject access code of practice earlier in the week, and it's ambiguous. In fact, it contradicts itself partway through. It just uses bad language in some places. I mean, I can give you a specific in a minute if I can find it. But what's your kind of library of guidance like, Ollie? Do you have your own library, and how do you keep it up to date?
I tend to. I think because I caught the tail end of what you were saying previously, which is to sort of save the PDF copies to my own stash, if you like, of guidance.
Stash
which,
of guidance.
Which is good in a way, but obviously I think you referred to it earlier, because of the lack of version control, or at least the lack of fanfare around version control, it becomes a bit of a juggling exercise trying to make sure that your guidance is up to date when you go to rely on it. So to a degree, then it becomes a bit redundant to have your own library of guidance because you're constantly checking the website versions. Anyway, I did do a little bit of thinking about this this morning, because obviously there's sort of the, and I'm sure you will have said this, but the piece of guidance that you rely on more regularly, whether that's because they are topical areas which are a bit more complex and require you to look at the guidance more. So personally, the one that I'm always working in or around are the direct marketing code of practice, which is in draft.
I think that's very good. I think that's fabulous.
Like that one. Well, the thing being, obviously, that direct marketing and the rules and regulations around it is so grey and so woolly at times, particularly the laws which are the regulations in PECA, which are very, very broad. You require that level of guidance. You require sort of a breakdown of what is actually, you know, direct marketing, or what is a solicited message, for instance. Well, that's possibly slightly easier to answer, but you take my point that by virtue of the topic area, the guidance is required. But there's also a whole lot of guidance that I don't rely on nearly as much as maybe I should. And there was one that came to mind when I was trying to think about it. Now, it's one of the ones possibly in line with something you mentioned recently, which is the fact that some of it's now out of date, or at least hasn't been updated since the introduction of the recent key statutory instruments. But one I was looking at a while ago and I thought was really good was the ICO's guidance on the use of cloud computing.
Yeah, that
dates back to 2012, so some of the terminology is a bit out of date, but some of the concepts it touches on are actually really useful and really quite interesting. You sort of think it's a bit of a shame that there's, I mean, I suppose they don't maybe not have the resources for it, but it's a bit of a shame that it's not been brought up to date. because it touches on some very good and interesting concepts.
I think they are working through their guidance library, and most of the old guidance does say this is out of date, but we're working on it. But I don't know what I mean. I wonder what resources they've got on writing guidance. You remember Phil Davison used to work for us. He spent 10 years at the ICO, but he was largely involved in writing a lot of their guidance. But, you know, they have a team on it, but, you know, surely it can't take that long to get through. You know, there's 40 pieces of guidance in there. Surely it can't take that long to get through it.
Well, see, I'm not sure on the number of pieces of guidance, because it's something we were referring to earlier, which is that they're not necessarily that easy to actually find. They don't have sort of a comprehensive index that you can go and look at and go, oh, I need to know about X. I'll go and check their index and I'll find what I need. So yeah, that's quite relevant. Yeah.
This is the bit that I was, I mean, maybe I've misread this or taking a strange view of it, but, you know, you're looking at this guidance, yeah, and if I was a relative layperson, you know, what's the basic rule? And it says here, you know, there's an exemption in the DPA that says if you don't have to comply with a SAR, if it would mean disclosing information about third party, you do have to comply with a SAR. You have to at least go back to them and say, we're not complying, you know, we're not going to disclose the data. But this is such a misleading statement, again, in my view. It's a highly misleading statement. I mean, they correct it later on, and they say here, you do need to respond, you know. But this whole kind of you don't have to comply is like, well, why use that language? The language of this guidance is critical, isn't it? Because we're reading into it, you know, what it actually says. And if you're defending your position, so, well, you said you don't have to comply. You know, well, you should have read further on. Well, it's like four pages further on.
Well, I'd
you
assume,
have to piece things together sometimes, I think.
Yeah,
what I'm saying, I guess.
I'd assume that particular turn of phrase comes from the fact that in the original law under Section 16, Schedule 2, Data Protection Act, which is where that comes from, I think that's the right quotation anyway. I believe it's worded in that you don't have to comply with a subject access request to the extent that it would require you to disclose information about third parties. Now, that's worded in a very specific way, which is that obviously you don't have to comply in areas or particular documents or particular instances where that would be the case. It's not a general exemption from the right of access if it involves third party data. So I assume that's possibly where that nuance has come from. But you're right, it's really important to get the wording right, because otherwise, as you say, you shouldn't have to go digging four pages down necessarily to clarify a bizarre statement like that.
Yeah, this is one of my favourite ones here, which we use in training quite a lot. Sorry if this feels like it's a bit of a hobby horse. It's not meant to be. So this is about, you know, this is the ICO's guidance on what is personal data. I think it's a great piece of work. And the Working Party 29 have also got a fantastic piece, what is personal data. But we ask people about, we talk a lot about photographs, don't we? You know, and this passage here, you know, the photograph of the shop includes images of pedestrians walking past at the time the photo was taken. The estate agent is not processing the shop data and anything about the pedestrians. This is kind of like, what's the purpose of the photograph? And therefore, it says further in here, in the hands of the estate agents, the photo does not contain personal data about pedestrians walking past their shop. So, you know, what we're now saying is that you have a look at some information, and then its purpose is vitally important to determine whether or not this is personal data or not. Now, this is 2012 guidance, so, you know, the definition of personal data has slightly changed, I suppose. But then they go on here to say, and I use this in training a lot, at about the same time the photograph was taken, a bank raid took place on the same high street. The police might make a public appeal for information about the movement on the high street at that time. The estate agent might supply to the police a copy of the photo in response to the appeal. The police would then process the photo, and at which point it may be personal data. So again, I say to people, you know, what you look at in one day may become personal data the next day, depending on what you're doing with it. And getting that concept to kind of go back to understand that concept that information, it may be personal data one day and maybe not personal data the next day, is really, you know, and you're doing a sign, you're getting photographs, you know, what was the purpose of the photograph? Because in the ICO's guidance, surely that becomes relevant as to whether it's personal data, therefore disclosable. I mean, this is the sort of thing we love yarning about, isn't it, in the pub. I'm just going to flip back and kill my screen share. Yeah, so that's one of my favourite passages. It's old now, 2012, but it's still there in the ISO's website. Therefore, you know, is it still relevant? Is it still persuasive?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? I was to hark back to the case I raised earlier. We were talking about mobile apps because the ICO has a piece of guidance on privacy in mobile apps guidance for developers.
They do, yeah.
But they released that in 2013. And again, you sort of ask yourself the question, you flick through it and you go, well, how relevant is this now? And you have to sort of weigh it up. I mean, to be honest, in this particular context, I think it's still probably very relevant. There was nothing that sort of jumped out at me as being outdated when I had a flick through it. But you're right, it can be an issue.
Well, if you don't have the confidence to kind of work it through and challenge it, which many people don't because they haven't studied the law to that level, you feel kind of in limbo, a bit out to sea. And what's happened a couple of times, and I know Dilik's on the call, you know, somebody gets hold of this out-of-date data or looks at the ISO's website, the wrong piece, part of it, and starts challenging, you know, their data protection officer or us, saying, well, I've read here on the ISO's website, it says this, or I've read here in this guidance, it says that. Okay, well, you've got to take it in the round. You know, you've got to consider other factors. But you know, if to some people they don't, they look at the you know, the stuff that's out there. I'm like saying, get it up to date or take it down, because it can get misused. And we had a right ding dong with somebody who was, you know, telling us about subject action requests. So we're reading the four data subjects part of the ICO's website. That's the wrong part to read. You need to be reading the stuff about controls and organizations, because you're a controller. You know, and what it says in the piece about data subjects in that context is not relevant. It's the wrong approach to take, but you know, they wouldn't have it. It was a difficult conversation.
I think there's possibly a wider point there, maybe about, I don't know, maybe it's a training issue potentially, but I've told you that on a number of occasions I've had issues with clients where they're just not, as you say, not reading the right part of either the guidance or sometimes not even the right part of the law. The number of times that we've had the law enforcement directive incorrectly quoted at us, because that's obviously part three of the Data Protection Act, and people say, oh, under section X, the Data Protection Act, and you instantly go, well, hang on, that's the law enforcement directive. You're a housing provider, that doesn't apply to you. Or, you know, the other one that I get all the time is people referring to a Schedule 2 exemption of the Data Protection Act, which is crime and crime prevention purposes. And they say, oh, well, under this, that's our lawful basis. I say, well, no, that's an exemption from providing privacy information or acknowledging subject rights. That's not a lawful basis. It specifically says right there that you can't rely on it as a lawful basis. So I don't know where that issue maybe stems from. Maybe it's a training thing. Maybe it's the responsibility of an organisation falling on the shoulders of someone who's possibly not come out for it. I don't know where it comes from, but it's something which we come up against constantly, misquoting things and misreading things.
Yeah, I'm just having a look actually at the ICO's guidance on the GDPR, which I think my screen's flickering. I don't know if it's showing, but that has actually got version control in it. This is on version 61, and in it is what's changed. My screen's flickering. I don't know if you can see it. So they said in January 21, you know, they published an updated communication, you know, following the UK Trade Corporation Group. So absolutely on the money there, aren't they? That's very recent. But I don't think these what's new things account for 61 different changes. But I prefer to have this 300-page document in PDF because I can work through it. Rather than trying to navigate it on their website, which is how they seem to want to push out their guidance now. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that I would like to see in all guidance with, you know, we've changed this, you know, and therefore we've incremented the version number.
No, I'd have to agree with you on that. I would have to agree with you.
Yeah. So what about you know, the blogs, you know, what blogs and newsletters do you kind of subscribe to, Ollie? Where do you get information about this type of stuff? Where do you get other opinion about? Because it's not just what the guidance says, it's how it's interpreted, isn't it? It's what other people in the industry are saying about the law and about the guidance and about case law as well.
No, definitely. Well, I think very much like you, I'm an avid user of Lexology and their updates. Just very useful, bite-size, timely.
That's a free one, isn't it, Lexology? It's a daily free newsletter.
I think they probably have a paid solution as well.
As well, yeah.
But yeah, no, that's always quite useful. And to be completely honest, I often find of real use to me is my network on LinkedIn. There's always good conversations on there. There's always things being shared. There's people who are always up to speed and on the money. Now, that's not to say that obviously differences of opinion don't mean that, you know, maybe people argue about things and maybe that some takes aren't quite right sometimes. But that's all part of it, really. I think even where something's been read slightly incorrect, there's still value in that. Because you can have that conversation and you can find those developments and talk about them. I don't know how you feel about that aspect of it, but it's something that I've found quite useful of late, particularly.
It certainly is. Lexology, I think, is great. It's my first job I do every morning is just have a quick scan through. There's always something quite interesting, and usually you link through to an article written by usually a law firm. Some of it is recycling content, some of it's out of date, but in the main, I have to say most days, you know, we find something that we either do blog about or could blog about. You know, it's some kind of stimulus to thought, which I find very useful. But it's usually in Lexology I find that the European Data Protection Board or the ICO have issued new guidance, or that's where cases get commented on. So that, again, that's my usual source of finding out, oh, there's been an interesting case about, you know, extraterritoriality being tested. You know, I found that through an article in Lexology. So again, I keep all that lot in my library. But what I'm not very good at is the metadata bit. So searching for something, you know, I put it in the title, but what I'd like to be able to do is have a much better way of indexing this stuff. So if we're looking for, you know, cookies, then we find you know, the cookie law, the cookie guidance, and, you know, relevant, credible, useful guidance on cookies. That's something that we've got as a target, haven't we, to improve our indexing of our library this year.
Sure. I mean, a lot of it, I think, for us and the rest of the support team, a lot of it's finding out about these things through the grapevine, essentially. Because then it's, yeah, you know, either it's Lexology or it's yourself or it's one, or it's Dilik or it's Dave circulating it, or as I said before, through, you know, the social media and hearing about it that way, which isn't really the most effective way, arguably. That probably highlights a bit of an issue in terms of communication in the sector, possibly. But you do sometimes feel that you've missed something, you know, a big decision's handed down, you know, a new code of practice or piece of guidance is published. And I do find it sometimes really quite easy to miss these things, which is unfortunate. But,
yeah,
you know,
actually, one of my favorite pieces of guidance, yeah, for like forever, was way back like 1998, the ICO produced a data protection compliance audit handbook. And I've got that on because they gave it out at their show. What do they call it? Exhibition. No, they don't call it a show. They have an event, don't they, every year. You're lucky to get on if you do. But they used to give out this audit handbook on DVD. You know, I printed it out and put it together. And yeah, it's fine. It's for auditing compliance against the 98 Act. But it's a brilliant bit of guidance. It's got a whole front end is about audit theory, about sampling, about question phrasing. And then it's got, you know, how to go about auditing compliance against the DPA 98, and then a whole load of checklists, and you know, we used that as a basis for designing our own audit framework when we were, you know, doing a lot of compliance auditing and our audit training. It's really, really good. So that you can actually find it if you hunt about on the internet, but it's a really good read, and it's so relevant to, you know, if you're wanting to think about how are we going to actually audit this. You know, read through that. Yeah, okay, it's out of date and it needs tweaking, but it's a brilliant piece of work that they put together a long time ago. And you know, and again, that's good. There are people that kind of put this stuff out and hold it, you know, indefinitely. So you find it. Another thing that I struggle with a little bit with the ICO is another great source of of guidance or interpretation is on their enforcement activity, isn't it? So they recently fined, I think, OLS Communications for email marketing. And there's lots of people who have been fined for email marketing. But if you read through the arguments the ICO puts together, why this organization broke the law, which bits of it broke the law, which bits of it weren't good enough, it really provides you with a great framework to supplement the guidance about, well, the ICO, you know, is either, you know, taking the guidance a little bit further, or in practice, you know, this is how it's applied. So reading the case law is great, but it doesn't stay up there for long, does it? So it might stay up there for a couple of years, but some of the older stuff is gone. You've got to go to other websites, you know, people who've taken it off and have PDF'd it and have stored it themselves. So there is a back catalogue of ICO guides, but they don't keep it on their site, which again, is, I think it's a real shame. Do you use the case history much, Ollie, from the ICO, their enforcement action?
Yeah, this is something I was going to raise, actually, is that in certain circumstances, and even though there's a lot of very good guidance about both from the ICO and other sources, I don't know how much you've mentioned it, but obviously the previously Article 29 Working Party and then subsequently European Data Protection Board, and a lot of their guidelines are really excellent. I think we mentioned earlier, that's something that I particularly like. But no, a lot of guidance to be taken from enforcement action. And I, even though obviously it's possibly less persuasive now, even from the European regulators, sometimes just digging around in case and saying, oh, look what's happened over there. Why was this decision come to? You know, how have they taken this approach to their enforcement action? I think it's a really useful resource. I really have to agree with you on that.
Mm. Again, two bits of guidance, I think, are fantastic bits of work. Do you remember the International Chambers of Commerce produced the best guidance ever on cookies back in 2011 or something? It's now out of date and superseded. But that was kind of people who aren't regulators, or certainly not the ICO, issuing guidance. And the Data Protection Network's guidance on legitimate interests, this kind of version two, I think is a stunning piece of work. Is they've got like 20-odd examples of, you know, this scenario, legitimate, you know, how would you go about the legitimate interests test? Again, it's not official guidance, it's not produced by a regulator, but it's really good guidance and again, freely available. It's a great piece of work. Have you seen that one?
Yes, I do really like that one. I think it's excellent. I think that's the one in which they include their own template for a legitimate interest assessment.
That's right, yeah.
Which is far superior to the one that the ICO put out. Or other ones that I've seen around. I think another good one that I like, and I was going to mention this, I don't know if you have yet, but in a similar vein, is the Surveillance Camera Commissioner Code of Practice.
Yes, that I've not mentioned that, no.
While that's quite specific and possibly to a degree slightly tangential to all of this, is another really good source to go and look at, particularly for us to make better, more informed decisions about CCTV, which are obviously significant privacy concerns about that. It's often something that we're asked to look at, and you sometimes have to have a slightly more extensive knowledge of these things than purely the data protection side of things. So again, a really good resource to go and look at, which is possibly slightly outside the scope of what traditionally we would look at.
It all takes time, doesn't it? Again, I've found the AEPD, the Spanish regulator's data protection by design and by default guidance, some maybe a year or so ago, because we were doing training on privacy by design and by default. And I looked at the ICO's 300-page guidance, and it's not very, doesn't say much of any substance, but the AEPD, you know, brings out seven principles of data protection by design and by default and elaborates on how those principles should be applied in practice. Again, a really good piece of work, but how do you, it's in English as well, how do you get it if you don't know about it? You know, that's part of the challenge, isn't it? You know, everyone's got time pressures and you haven't got time to be just trolling around on the internet all day having a look for, so that's new. But, you know, that's why it's important to have a professional networker that says, you know, you've got to be looking at this because it's really good, or, you know, that's actually a better piece of guidance to look at, you know. And the cases as well, you know, the court cases, you know, are more difficult to read, I find, than the ICO's enforcement notices, which are really easy to read. But It's having the time into to get across this stuff and then sharing it with people so everyone's got the same access to the same level of knowledge. That's really what we want to be trying to do, really. What's your favourite guidance then, Ollie? Have you got a favourite?
Yeah, I'm going to say direct marketing code of practice.
Oh, are you? That's mine as well, actually.
Yeah. Do you want me to pick another one then?
No. I think it's...
No,
why is it your fave?
Well, it sort of alludes to what I was saying before, which is partly the whole direct marketing side of things, I personally think is an area which does require sort of that degree of guidance because it can be so complex and the laws around it can be so woolly to start. So that's one reason. But also, I think it's very well written. It's relatively clear, or as clear as you possibly could be on a lot of these things. The most recent version, so the code of practice, as opposed to the old guidance, which also existed, it's really quite comprehensive, actually. Generally, it's one that I work with a lot, and I've very rarely had issues with it. I find that it's quite easy to navigate. When I need to go and find something, it's good. And also, as I've probably mentioned in the past, it finally provides some vindication for me on the issue of whether regulatory communications can actually be caught by PECA, which is a hill I chose to die on quite some time ago. I've been arguing for a while now, particularly in the housing sector, because obviously under the Regulator for Social Housing's Tenant Empowerment Standards, there are requirements to communicate with tenants, and I've often had that thrown at me as justification for why we don't have to comply with PECA when we're communicating with tenants. And I've often said that wasn't necessarily the case, but this guidance finally came down on one side of the fence. And it's provided much more persuasive argument, so that's another reason I like it.
If you can see it on my screen share, still, unfortunately, still draft code for consultation. I mean, I don't actually know technically whether that means it's enforceable, in action, reliable. I mean, I suspect it is, but that's only my gut feel. But the previous version was, I think was that purple as well? And, you know, so it's noticeably different, the way that the ISO is now sort of branding up their new guidance. But why I like this the most is because it's really clear about B2B email communications and about communications by phone, you know, whether or not they're caught by a PECA. And it's got a little somewhere in it. It's got a little matrix of tick boxes and little crosses, and it's so clear, it's so easy to use. I agree with you, it's well written, it's well structured, but it answers a lot of questions which the old guidance just left hanging. And it's
I was just gonna say, well, it addresses the point of corporate subscriber, which is one which you've talked about quite a bit in the past, haven't you? The concept
It doesn't address it as much as we'd want, but
it provides a little bit more insight into it, which is always nice.
But it changes the goalpost, because in the past the goalpost was, if it's sales at, you know, dataprotectionpeople.com, that's a business email. If it's philip.browning@dataprotectionpeople.com, that isn't some people's interpretation. We've always said, well, that is, you know, and now the guidance is saying that it is, you know, so it doesn't actually say that explicitly, unfortunately, but you can definitely take out of this direct marketing code of practice the emails to people's business addresses is a corporate subscriber. You obviously got to be careful that it's not a sole trader or a partnership, but the guidance is a lot better than the previous guidance. And if the ISO can keep building on this, you know, they're going to rework their anonymization code of practice, so that's due to get changed, rewritten this year. Again, that'll be really interesting, because things have probably changed, techniques have changed since that was last written. But that should be, you know, guidance that builds on and answers questions. One would think that the ICO gets questions into their support desk, and that's what helps drive the codes of practice as well as changes in the law. I don't quite know what the process is. But that's also my favourite guidance, Ollie. I think it's a really good bit. It's 124 pages, well worth printing out, well worth annotating, well worth read. What about European guidance? Do you spend much time? I know you spend a bit of time on the CNIL website, don't you, and the French regulator?
Yeah, I do actually. That's purely because I feel like it's a niche which I may as well exploit.
But I think their DPIA guidance, I think, is better than the ICO's. I think the ICO's DPIA guidance is the worst ever. In fact, two versions ago, the ICO had a really good DPIA handbook. You remember, you probably don't know, the ICO's branding was yellow and blue, and they did a really good DPIA handbook, which was fab. And then they watered it down, and the current version, I think the template at the back is horrendous. You know, it doesn't force you to look at the data protection principles. You know, it's not in there. You know,
I know the one you mean, the one that asks about three or four questions and then provides three or four very open questions.
Yeah.
And then basically, you know, asks you to crack on. I know the one you mean. No, I the more time I've spent on the CNIL website, the more I like it, for a variety of reasons, and one of which being that actually they're very active. They're constantly doing stuff, they're constantly posting updates. I noticed the other day that they run a I'm not sure what you would call it, but they run this piece which is their breach of the trimester. So every trimester they highlight a different form of breach or cyber attack, and they write a big old piece about it. So, you know, what are the most common factors, what are things that you can do to mitigate them, how to recognize them. This month's one is on, well, this trimester's one rather, is on credential stuffing, brute force attacks, and it's really quite a good piece. It's aimed both at businesses and individual users, and it's just the sort of thing which I'd like to see the ICO do. This sort of thing, it just feels more involved, it feels more proactive. You know, it's possibly not going to change the world, but it's a nice symbol of intent, I would say, a nice sign of intent. And yeah, generally I've really enjoyed and appreciated the work they put out on their website, and I wish to a degree that the ICO sort of took heed of it and followed in their step a little bit more, to be completely honest.
Probably down to resources. I mean, somebody was asking earlier on, good question. Does it matter what the European regulators put out? I mean, some of it is stuff, and it's all basically working with the same law, aren't we? And the interpretation of the law is all either highly useful or educational. You know, you can pick out bits of the guidance from the various regulators. I'm not sure you could pick out much of the case law. You know, the European Court of Justice case law is useful and good. But some of the other case law is hard to get hold of. I was looking with Boyko maybe a year ago at some Bulgarian case law, and you know, it's just not accessible in English. So I asked Boyko to translate a lot of it for me. But I have to say the translation tool is a lot better these days. You just chuck it into that free translation tool I use, and it's fantastic. We've paid for translations in the past, but having free tools is really good. What's the time? It's 12:26. What are we meant to be doing next or now? Are we on to we'd spend a bit of time talking about guidance and looking at it? Oh, I said we'd do that till 12:30. It's nearly 12:30 now. Any kind of final thoughts, Ollie? Any questions or comments from anybody else about the types of guidance available? Anything that you want to see? You know, anything we can do to help? You know, any final thoughts, Ollie?
There's nothing from me. I think we've probably covered the topic as extensively as we can in a short period of time. I do think that sort of the main point is that generally, I speak for myself, but possibly other colleagues, it'd be nice to have better visibility of these things and better access, I think, generally. I think that's sort of the key theme, because it does feel a bit frustrating when you've missed out on something just because you've had your head buried in a SAR or whatever it might be. So to me, that's sort of the key theme around all of this. I think, unless anyone's got anything else to add or any questions to throw in, I think we're meant to be doing another open surgery again.
We are. Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think, and I might be wrong, the accountability framework is actually out there as official guidance, is it? I think it's just like a framework as a paper the ICA has put together. Again, that's quite good, but not very specific. When that came out, I hoped it would be much more pragmatic, much more, you know, practical, giving me, you know, you got to do this and this is how to do it. But it doesn't really do that. It talks kind of, it seems to talk in woolly concepts, but also it's not alone as a document. It's folded into other stuff. And I think that will be really useful to put out some guidance about accountability, because it's I was looking at the data sharing code of practice this morning, the new data sharing code of practice, and we woven right throughout that is this kind of notion of accountability, you know. And in terms of data sharing, there's any of fairness and transparency and security, lawfulness of processing, your key accountability triggers, really. But again, I think there is room to have some really good official guidance spelling out what is expected of data controllers in the accountability space, because I think that's still so I think it's still a bit open and a bit loose, to be honest.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Sorry, I just got caught off guard there because I'm keeping an eye on support and urgent breach has just come in. I'm going to ask Jazz to pick that up if she can.
I think Paul's got a great point, Paul, about the Isle of Man Commission. I mean, this is the thing. It's all the various regulators. The Irish regulator obviously publishes in English. Most of them do, actually. Whether they will continue to remain to be seen. But the Isle of Man regulator has done some, the commissioner has done some good guidance. There is some good stuff out there. Right, so we'd talk a little bit about the guidance that's available, and the, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly. The role of European guidance has still got a place to play. I think some of it's still very good, some of it's out of date, as Jason said. Some of it is being actively superseded, other of it is being supplemented with new stuff. But as a kind of a student of the law, it's still really useful to have a look back over some of this stuff, even if you just to understand how we've got to this point. You know, understanding the stepping stones. Well, for me, that's important. Maybe it's not as for most practitioners. Maybe they don't want to dwell on how we've got where we are. Just kind of, this is what I've got to do. Fine. I like to understand the journey. But maybe I'm just an old fogey like that. So we said we'd do another kind of a surge where we'll talk through any questions that people have got. Coming up after this, we're gonna explore the interaction between the Data Protection Act and how it actually works with UK GDPR and the PECA. We might touch on the EU GDPR as well. I've got on my notes here, we need to put a slide together, Ollie, to help illustrate this, but I don't think I'll have time to do that. So we'll be referring to Matthew's blog and the graphic we put together there, or it'll be just a talky session. And then we'll be talking about the challenges for small businesses in terms of their protection, some of the misconceptions, the registration piece. I think probably a delve into how the Roper exemption does work. And maybe we've got a couple of good slides on, you know, this is the GDPR in a nutshell, that one slide A4, and the same with a PECA. So we'll be coming on to that. And then the accountability, as I said earlier, we'll be looking at accountability and possibly touch on the framework. But really, we're going to have a look at three or four different tools for accountability and record keeping. That's coming up this afternoon. So we're either going to be talking, if people have got any questions or points to raise or stuff you want to just chat through, they don't have to be. Don't have to be a surgery or such, it has to be a chat. So we'll do that now. And if we haven't got anything, then maybe we'll have a look at some of the cases that we've recently had to handle and take them apart. But if you've got a question, then drop it into the chat or unmute. I'm going to shut down that window there now. I'm talking to myself here, going mad.
That's fine. So, don't you worry. I'm just pulling up some cases which we've done recently, just in case anyone hasn't got any questions or points they want to raise.
So, what's been the kind of themes coming through in the cases, Ollie? Have we had any common themes coming through? Any questions? I mean, the Brexit stuff sort of seems to have died down. We had a lot of questions just before Christmas, didn't we, about that? But
well, actually, the Brexit stuff hasn't necessarily died down. It's sort of changed focus now, if anything, because we're getting a whole lot of people coming to us and saying, we've got this template agreement that we normally use, or our supplier's got this template agreement that we normally use. it references the EU GDPR, what do we do? And all sorts of variations thereof. So, oh, we've been sent this letter of variation to update to the UK GDPR, X, Y, and Z. And in some instances, it seems perfectly reasonable, if a little bit premature, because in some instances, they're talking about updating standard contractual clauses and all sorts pre a potential adequacy decision. So we've been telling some people to hold off. But in some instances, it does feel like overkill slightly when people are looking to rewrite some of their processing agreements just to update some of these things, because the wording substantially and the effect of the clauses doesn't necessarily change in some instances. I don't know if you've seen any of these, Phil, but we've gotten quite a lot of that.
I have to say I haven't, Ollie, but I think that the ICO is saying that during this bridge period, which I think finishes in May, does it, or April, and then there's potential extension to July, they're saying, you know, you got to get on with it, you got to start acting now. So you know, that their advice is doing what it looks like customers are doing. My, you know, it may all change again in July, but there's an awful lot of work going into updating you know, the agreements, or you know, your processes or your policies or your procedures or whatever. But I've not seen any specifically come through. I've not been asked to have any in the support framework.
No, I think I've probably been badgering Dave with them, to be honest. But no, there has been a bit of that. But all that to say, essentially, that Brexit is still very much alive and well within our line of work, as it is for a lot of our clients in wider issues outside of data protection. We work with some clients who have been affected quite heavily by Brexit in their day-to-day operations. So no, it's very much alive and well. I'm just looking now.
I've been dealing a lot I've been dealing a lot. Most of my kind of work on the support desk has been working with the questions on the PCI DSS. So we kind of added that into the support desk framework, didn't we? So people can ask us anything that they want about the PCI DSS, and we've got the network of consultants there that are doing the PCI DSS work, and you know, that's been really great. But as soon as we kind of took it felt like I was taking a cork out of a dam, because we got an absolute inundated with support tickets on PCI DSS, and since then we've been on quite a lot of calls actually with customers and their suppliers to talk through the nuances of, you know, you've got this thing, this project, this payment channel, and it's being provided in this way. And you know, so it seems to me that there is a general, seems like, maybe I'm wrong, but a lack of resources in terms of, you know, support out there for anybody who's got questions about the PCI DSS. I mean, there's the Security Council publishes a ton of information, which is, I have to say, usually very boring to read, but you know, pretty good. But the fact that we've got, you know, a lot of customers ringing up or putting in support tickets saying, you know, I'm not sure about this point, would suggest that there's a lot of it's usually with the kind of smaller, you know, level 3, 4, 2 operators, level 1, where they've maybe got a compliance team who are trained, you know, in the standard. Maybe they've got better resources, but there's definitely been, you know, an uptick in the questions we've had about PCI. Now, I've been dealing with them a lot, Ollie.
No, fair enough. Jason's just asking. So Jason says, supply due diligence and the wording Article 28 compliant process contracts is a big topic for us at the moment. Yeah, likewise. We are now doing retrospective due diligence on long-established suppliers, and many of them still reference the DPA 98. Yeah, we see that a lot as well, let alone the EU GDPR. This might be okay if the wording says, or any other applicable data protection legislation which modifies or supersedes, etc., but many of them don't. Yeah, completely on board with you, Jason. It's sometimes baffling that these agreements still only reflect the 98 Act. And I mean, to be honest, it's not even sometimes agreements. We've been doing work with some new clients recently, looking at some of their policies, which still reflect the 98 Act and don't even mention the GDPR. And you have to say that is sometimes a bit baffling that that's the case. But no, the point on superseding legislation, Absolutely, which is why in some instances, as you say, it might be okay, but still worth looking at, and obviously a big task for a lot of organisations at the moment going through all of this as you're going.
Repapering everything. I picked up an interesting one the other day, actually, Ollie, which was so there's a couple of companies out there that are kind of brokering data. This is called ZoomInfo, right? And somebody was asking me to have a look at it from a, you know, we want to use this. Would you have a look at it from a due diligence point of view? So I did have a look at it. And how it works is you basically sign up for this free service where you can mine data. And what it says in the terms and conditions is that by signing up to use this service, they will read all your inbound and outbound email traffic and scrape data off headers and footers. So that's how they compile their database. So by signing up to do this, you're basically agreeing to that, which brings to the fore lots of complicated questions about, you know, fairness of processing and so on and so forth. So that's one way that they collect their data. So the more people sign up for this allegedly free service, then the more information they've got, and they cross-reference it and they corroborate it. So you can imagine they've probably got an enormous database now, and then they sell it, you know. So my if my email's gone into, if they say you subscribe to this service ZoomInfo as a business, and I email you, and your app, you know, the ZoomInfo app scrapes my phone number, my email address, my name, my job title, you know, anything else that's in my email footer, and populates their database with it. And then somebody else might go and buy my record because I'm a director of a small business, and then start marketing to me. And, you know, I was actually really disturbed about what was happening here. But I was really considering whether, you know, I'm pretty sure, and I approached ZoomInfo. I said, you know, you need to I'm working for somebody and I want to have this information. And they refused point blank to talk to me. They said, you need to get the person in the company you're working with to talk to their account manager at ZoomInfo. They're kind of trying to cut me out as a privacy person, which is a bit worrying. But what I was kind of considering is this. So the information that's being scraped from the emails has been done so without it being fairly undertaken. You know, not anywhere in the privacy information that's been supplied to me by you, for instance, tells me that you're going to do this with my personal data, or you're going to allow a third party to do it. So, you know, when I come to buy that data to reuse it, can I avoid that kind of initial unfair processing by immediately providing you with an Article 14 compliant privacy notice that says, oh, I've now got your personal data, I'm going to use it for direct marketing purposes, and I obtained it from ZoomInfo. Is the whole chain totally and utterly undermined through that initial lack of clarity, or can we interject some clarity and some transparency and some lawfulness at the point that I start using it? I have to say, I've not reached a conclusion on that yet. I was mulling it over. I don't know what your thoughts are. But I mean, the whole process is like really, really dodgy, isn't it? Oh, they use it in America, so why can't we use it here? A different law. What's your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I'd have to say that does sound hugely dodgy. I actually went through a relatively similar, albeit slightly less intrusive and slightly less dodgy process with one of our clients who are a charity. And who had intended on doing some wealth screening on their database of donors. So essentially taking their database of previous donors and through various techniques which we're exploring with them, basically looking to identify either high-value donors, so people who could give a lot more, or people who potentially had a higher ceiling for their donations, so they could maybe push and ask for more. And they were looking at a variety of ways of doing this. And one way was that they'd... the supplier would approach them and basically said that what they did was that they compiled their own rich list, effectively, from various publicly available sources. So, for instance, directs to companies that you find on Companies House or anything like that, or they use sort of published rich lists in magazines or whatever, publicly available sources, essentially. And they said, well, can we use this? And I wasn't fully confident about it either, as you're sort of saying, Phil. is it fair to use that information if it wasn't fair in the first place? You know, can we inject fairness into that at a later stage? I'm not entirely sure.
No, I'm not. And this is the sort of thing that certainly Dave and I chat about. You know, Dave Holmes is now back on the call. We chat about, have a hour conversation on Friday night, you know, about this kind of stuff. And we talk about it, don't we? Jason occasionally rings me up and we kind of chew over, you know, is this right? Does it feel right? Is it likely to be right? You know, what does the, because the guidance doesn't cover this off really, does it? But it's a good point. Dave, we're just talking about, you know, we're looking at this product for a client. It's called Zoom Info, and basically, you know, it's a free service. You subscribe to it, you know, it's a database basically. But by agreeing to its terms, you agree to them installing an app on your computer, which scrapes footers or every email that comes in or goes out from your email clients, get all the header and footer information, and recipients get scraped off and shoved into Zoom Info's database. I'm pretty sure that our client isn't named in Zoom Info's privacy information. They might be named as in terms of a category of recipient, but they're certainly not named explicitly. And therefore, to me, it's that data is being collected unfairly. So, you know, when I come to buy that information, you know, to use if I'm a charity client like Ollie was suggesting, you know, by me then sending out privacy information under Article 14, does that, as Ollie says, does it inject at that point, you know, fairness, lawfulness, transparency into otherwise flawed data or the fact it hasn't been collected fairly in the first place? Does that kill the whole thing off from the very outset? Mr. Holmes, are you there?
Sorry, I was on the traditional mute just because it's Data Protection Day. I thought I'd come out with that comment if nobody has used it in my absence. I find it really interesting because it feels wrong to start with. So it's then, am I necessarily trying to work the law to substantiate or to back the fact that I think it's wrong, or am I going to use the law to try and prove that it's right? In that sense. So I guess it depends where you're coming from with your focus, but it does naturally feel wrong. You may have agreed for the app to be on your computer, but do you necessarily think it's fair that anybody sending you an email, corporate or otherwise, is aware that you'll be scraping their footers for the purposes of selling their information to target them for marketing or otherwise? And you're absolutely right. You can do a kind of a just-in-time notice, can't you, with the privacy policy thing? Yeah. So you've got that. Well, let's just use the just-in-time principle to tell people at the latest stage possible, this is what we're doing and why we're doing it. But that would still, to me, negate the lawful basis of what you're doing at the point you're collecting the information. So what legal grounds are you relying on to do that? And if you're relying on legitimate interest for doing the scraping, for example, you could potentially use legitimate interest because there's no special category data potentially in there, unless they're scraping anything else other than just headers and footers.
So
let's assume then it's not personal data, not special category personal data, so therefore it's only normal personal data. Then what would be the lawful basis of doing that? Well, if you're going to go down the line of legitimate interest and making sure that what you're doing is fair and proportionate and not privacy intrusive, then I think you're probably fairly legitimate interest, unless you've made it explicitly clear from the outset, and that would probably negate the ability to use a just-in-time notice.
Well, it was certainly not within my reasonable expectations that my personal data will be used in that way by people using this system. You know, it came as a real shock to me, actually, that this was going on, if I'm being honest. But I mean, what's Article 14 there for, if it's not for this person? I tell you, I need to do some more reading about this, because the Data Sharing Code of Practice has a kind of a use case in it where similar scenario, you know, what you want to share personal data with another controller, you shunt it over to the other controller, and you know they have to send out an Article 14 notice. But that's, I think, premised on the fact it's been fairly and lawfully and transparently collected in the first place. So my initial thought is that it doesn't seem at all appropriate to start to argue that, you know, it's been unfairly, unlawfully and opaquely collected in the first place, but I can negate all that by sending out an Article 14 notice. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you can negate effectively the Article 14 is there for that purpose. I suspect it isn't. I suspect that it doesn't.
From my point, it doesn't feel like you should be able to do it. I'm not saying you can't, but it doesn't feel like you should be doing that point. And for me, it still comes back to the what is a lawful basis.
Sorry, I meant to say, Dave, that I don't know how it differentiates, but this is business data. So it's a business to business database. So it's a slight nuance in there as well.
Okay, so if I was just a general consumer, how does it tell that I'm a general consumer? And well, then I think kind of scrape that information and then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. They're not answering questions. They refuse to engage with me. But I guess, you know, if there's no business in the footer, then it may just chuck it into it. May chuck it into their consumer database, or it may chuck it into the bin. I don't know.
Precisely. So if it's consumer database, is it chucking it into the consumer side of things? Or if it's a sole trader, which is in the eyes of using a personal kind of email address, you're still possibly in the same bracket of, well, what are you going to do about people who aren't classed as corporate legal entities?
Yeah, but you'd get around that though yourself, wouldn't you? So if you wanted to use a database, you'd screen against a TPS, you'd screen against a CTPS, and you would probably do some due diligence and either say I don't want the sole traders, or you'll have to put your own process in because I don't think these guys will provide that level of screening for the information that they sell you. But it was just it came in as a question, and I'm still not entirely sure, you know, how best to approach it.
Yeah, but I can understand why it's causing kind of a bit of a headache to work your way through. But if business data, regardless of whether you're using it for marketing purposes, if your business data is still personal data about you, and you therefore you're still processing personal data, albeit identifying Phil as a director of a company in the UK. In that sense, it still is sufficient enough to identify you and say something about you as an individual. So if you end on line of it is business data, then what is a lawful basis that you're collecting that information under?
Yeah. So it's again back to this point of, you know, the UK GDPR or the GDPR and the PECA working together. So, you know, we talked about this in the early session when you were off. Wally was talking about cookies, you know, and the PECA. Has got certain regulations for cookies, which is, you know, governing and regulating the placing of information on someone's device and the reading of the information from someone's device, irrespective of whether there's personal data involved or not. And then the GDPR comes in when it's personal data and regulates the posing of personal data.
Which is
I think, what we're going to talk about next, isn't it? The way that those pieces of legislation sit together, and because there is some confusion about that. But anyway, that was an interesting an interesting thought. I mean, we love these kind of complicated cases where you want to be accurately interpreting the law. The guidance doesn't quite go far enough. You know, you might be persuaded by elements of an argument, but your gut feel is just doesn't sit right, doesn't feel right. Therefore, it probably isn't right.
No, absolutely. And it comes back to if we look to the comment I made at the very start of the session, when I first joined in, about data protection is not necessarily about protecting data, but about protecting the fundamental rights and freedoms of individuals as you process their data, kind of in that sense. So you could possibly look at, well, is the use of I forgot what you call it, the software, the Zoom Info, is the use of Zoom Info, will that fundamentally affect the fundamental rights and freedoms of individuals?
Yeah,
and if they don't know about it, or they don't know about it until a later point, at which point it is part of a database, and you're just waiting.